Hi, everyone. I'm Ashley Bassett.
And I'm Catherine Logan.
And welcome to Overtime with the Sports Docs. On each of these mini episodes, Catherine and I chat about a new topic or surgical technique in the field of sports medicine. We'll give you our quick take on the most recent data and whether or not this data will be impacting our practice.
So today we're going to give you an update pertaining one of our favorite topics, the ACL. And honestly, it's been a bit since we've done an episode on ACL, so we're excited to dive into this paper today and talk more about how it'll impact our practice. So we're going to review an article from the January issue of AJSM. It's titled, Risk of Revision and Reoperation After Quadriceps Tendon Autograft ACL Reconstruction Compared with Patella Tendon and Hamstring Autografts. It's a U.S. cohort of 21,973 patients. That's such a long title.
Oh my God, that is the longest title of all time.
As always, links to the papers that we discuss are going to be on our podcast website. That's www.thesportsdocspod.com.
If you're looking for a trusted name in osteochondral allograft transplantation, look no further than JRF Ortho. With a stellar track record and a reputation as the leader in fresh osteochondral allografts, JRF Ortho is here to elevate your practice to new heights.
JRF Ortho has proudly distributed over 25,000 allografts worldwide, making a significant impact in the field. Their passion for this industry goes beyond the numbers. It's about helping patients and fulfilling their mission of improving people's quality of life.
But that's not all. At JRF Ortho, they understand that superior customer care is crucial. They aim to give you one less thing to think about so you can focus on what matters the most, your patients.
And they make ordering JRF Ortho easy. They are committed to accommodating your needs and delivering allografts on your terms.
You're in control. Choose your scheduling option, whether it's specifying a surgical date, providing a date range, or just requesting the earliest available allograft. Your preferences are their top priority.
So, prepare for success. Order with JRF Ortho and take control of your orthopedic journey.
So we've tackled a lot of different ACL topics over the years, and we've specifically covered ACL graft choice in a game plan episode. I think it was our first ever game plan episode, if I'm remembering correct. Maybe our second? Yeah. In January of 2023, which honestly feels like ages ago. And I'm surprised we made it this long before doing another ACL episode. But that is episode 39, if you want to go check it out. And in that episode, we discussed different allograft and autograft options for ACL reconstruction. And we did discuss quadriceps tendon autograft at that time. So at that time, we explained that quad tendon is a newer autograft with less donor site morbidity compared to BTB and less graft size concerns compared to hamstring, especially in females. But quad, though a promising graft, doesn't have as much data as BTB. TB and hamstring due to being relatively newer, which is why we were really excited to see this paper pop up a couple months ago in AJSM, and we knew we had to cover it.
So this study is a level 2 retrospective cohort analysis. It was performed by Dr. I think it's Malatis and colleagues at Kaiser Permanente in San Diego. So the purpose of the study was to evaluate the risk of subsequent surgical outcomes after primary ACL reconstruction, including revision and reoperation, according to autograft selection. So the Kaiser Permanente ACL Reconstruction Registry was used to identify these patients who underwent primary autograft ACLR, so reconstruction, from 2012 to 2021. So surgical variables collected included meniscus pathology, operative time, tunnel drilling technique, but not graft harvest technique.
So what are your thoughts on that? I searched this paper when I was like looking through it, and I was looking everywhere for them to say all soft tissue.
Yeah.
They didn't. And they didn't talk about if it was like the quad pro, like a minimally invasive harvest, or if it was a big open incision, or if they took a bone block from the superior patella. So like, do you think that would make a difference in outcomes?
I don't know. You know, I would think it's got to impact it somehow. Mm-hmm. I just know from doing those like retrospective huge studies, like as a resident, that sometimes people just don't put that stuff in their op notes.
Yes.
So, just, you know, you're like, I really want to understand this data better. And you'd be like going through medical record after medical record. And I'd be like, why does this surgeon not dictate everything? You know?
I remember in my fellowship, I was doing a chart review on rotator cuff. And I made the list of my variables before I did it. And I was like, you know, I'm going to get the exact centimeter size of the rotator cuff and the exact level of retraction and the exact, and I'm going through and I was like, lucky if they put supraspinatus like in the op note. Like I was like, what was repaired, you know? So yeah, you're right. This is a huge registry, so they probably couldn't. But I do wonder if it impacts that. I feel like taking a bone block would lead to more like donor site morbidity and maybe better healing compared to all soft tissue. So I would really like to see like an analysis on that, but it wasn't in this paper.
I think I totally am with you. It's like you have these lofty ideas of like all the little things you want, and they're just not in there.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So in this paper, roughly 22,000 patients who underwent a primary autograft ACLR from 2012 to 2021 were included in this study. So procedures were performed by 290 surgeons. So again, going back to that variability that Catherine and I were just talking about, at 53 different healthcare centers in the organization. So of the ACLRs performed, 5% were quad, 43% were BTB, and 52% were hamstring. So before we dive into the results pertaining to revision and reoperation rates, there are a few things to discuss here. So Catherine, do you think the large number of different surgeons, do you think that's a benefit, more indicative of the community as a whole, or do you think that introduces too many variables?
I actually, you know, I honestly think it's a benefit. It's like, if you think of it, like the total joint registries, like all the Swedish registries, and we learned so much about why revisions happen and, you know, what's happening that leads to, say, total joint revisions due to infection or loosening or those types of things. So I do think that those huge registries, even though there's a lot of variability, they do have value for giving us some broad strokes. And anytime I'm talking about studies like this with patients, I always sort of say, you know, kind of it's colored by, is this reflective of a Colorado sort of population, or is this reflective of like a Louisiana, Texas, you know, sort of very different type of population. So I think you just have to think about it, but I do think there's a lot of value in there, but it's, you know, especially when they're not giving us that information about detail about technique or harvest.
Yeah.
You have to always sort of keep that in the back of your mind of how you're interpreting it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And then something like I was thinking about was that, you know, I have no data to back this up, but in my mind and in my experience and in my practice, I feel like younger and more newer trained surgeons are more likely to be doing the quad autograft ACL compared to more, I won't say experienced, but like longer term surgeons are more likely sticking with like the BTB or if they've been doing hamstring for many years. And so I kind of was thinking to myself, like, does that impact variables positively or negatively results wise? I don't know that I know the answer to that, but I do think it definitely introduces a little bit of a confounding, you know, aspect to this. But again, I think that it kind of all balances out, right? Because in the community, you're going to have young surgeons, middle-aged surgeons, older surgeons doing transtibial, anteromedial, bone block, no bone block. So it kind of just like equalizes it all and allows our results to be a little bit more generalizable. So I think we just, our readers, our listeners have to take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I think well said. And, you know, as you said before, only 5% of the ACLs were quad. The comparative analysis, they're only able to do 4 years. And you know, 52%, really high, were hamstring. So, I mean, it's surprising, but it's not. You know, when you think about it from the community, I do think we're so focused probably on the female athlete and knowing that there's, you know, a higher risk of them re-tearing it with the hamstring. So, you know, we just sort of say, oh, wow, I don't, you know, like, I don't know, it just seems surprising. But when I see people from the community that I've been to other surgeons, it's still, you know, pretty rampant. Yeah. So any thoughts on that piece, those pieces of data, Ashley?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think we take care of a lot of female athletes, which I think is also why we're doing a lot more quad, because we know kind of the issues that go with BTB in terms of patellofemoral pain, and we know that our female athletes have a higher risk of that. So I think we probably are more likely to tilt towards quad, and so we're doing a lot more quad. But yeah, I also was pretty surprised to see 52% were hamstring, and that kind of led me to want to know a breakdown by year. It's like I have so many questions for these authors. Yeah. I want to know so much information, which is probably not in the registry because of, you know, it's a registry study, but I would love to know the breakdown of percentage, like in 2021 and 2020 and 2019, like, is it still 52% hamstring, or is it more BTB and quad with like a touch of hamstring? And I assume it will probably be the latter as people are kind of shifting away from hamstring with all the newer data we have. So it would be interesting to see that. That's just one thing that popped in my head.
Yeah, No, makes sense. So with regards to the primary outcome of revision surgery, no significant differences were observed in revision risk or reoperation risk when comparing quad to BTB or quad to hamstring. So, however, when hamstring was compared to BTB, hamstring ACLRs were known to have a higher risk of revision surgery compared to BTB, but a lower risk of reoperation. Mm-hmm. So, discuss. What do you think, Ashley?
So, I found it very interesting. Not too surprising. I found the revision risk being more elevated. And if you look specifically at by age, they found that though the risk of revision in all hamstrings was elevated compared to BTB, it was much, much higher in people that were younger than the age of 22 with a revision rate of 10.2% compared to 6.7% with BTB. So I think this just highlights, you know, our need to really lower that risk of need for revision in our younger cohorts. And I just feel like that kind of does indicate kind of staying away from hamstring. And then the lower reoperation rate due to less stiffness makes sense. We know BTB is associated with greater stiffness. I don't think that was a staggering thing. I think that hamstrings, we know, lead to less stiffness in the knee, and BTB leads to more stiffness. So operation for arthrofibrosis being higher in BTB patients didn't really surprise me. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is all very like promising for quad. Mm-hmm. As far as, sorry, I gotta shut off these beeps. Those are my you know, I think this is all very promising for quad. I think, you know, it's showing good comparisons to both of the two gold standards that have been around for a long time. And I think it's more and more reason that, you know, hamstring is really falling out of favor, although I know mm-hmm. some people still love it. I just, you know.
Boston. Boston loves it.
Yeah.
We're retrained. People in Boston were phenomenal surgeons, like love hamstring. So.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I think this data makes me really happy to see that, you know, with that variability, you know, that, you know, meaning like large scale, good amount of like surgeons and different institutions, that the quad is looking really good.
Absolutely. So the authors go on to perform a number needed to treat analysis, which I really like because as a non-stats person, it really helps me kind of understand the numbers, like how many people would we need to treat with a BTB to prevent one revision with a hamstring. So that makes it a little easier for me to understand. So they found that a surgeon would have to perform 573 ACL reconstructions with quad to see one more revision compared with BTB. So like pretty equivalent, right? But in contrast, compared to hamstring ACLR, a surgeon would have to perform 62 ACL reconstructions with quad tendon to prevent one revision. But if a patient were less than 22 years of age, only 30 ACL reconstructions would have to be performed to prevent one revision. So again, pretty significant findings there that we should be tilting our patients, you know, in the cases of wanting to do a soft tissue graft and avoid the issues with BTB and maybe avoid putting a bone block over a growth plate, if we're talking about young people, maybe steering that person towards quad rather than hamstring, or, you know, steering them towards BTB over hamstring. But kind of exactly what you said, I think the tables are turning in terms of away from hamstring.
Yeah. Anything that you know, like, I didn't see anything in there that there was a reason to say, like, we should be worried about quad in any way. I don't know if you picked up anything, but I didn't really pick up anything. It all seemed very positive for quad, which is exciting.
It was very exciting. And that's why I was excited about this paper, because I had a patient, and I like this physical therapist very much, but I always give people a choice, right? And I'm like, BTB has more data on it because it's been around. I mean, the first free BTB graft, I only know this because I presented on this morning when talking about ACL repair, was in 1960. So it was like, that was it's a long time. We've got a lot of data on this. And quad just isn't that, you know, it's newer compared to that. And so I give people the option, and she went to her PT and she was all for quad. She's 14 years old. I was like, we should do a quad, but here's your option. You decide. And she talked to her PT and he was like, you should do BTB. He was like, because I can tell you how BTB does. I can't tell you how quad does. And I get his reasoning with that. But now I'm hoping that as we have more data, we have a little bit more confidence to tell our patients, like, this is a great graft. You know, like, it's not, we're not guessing, you know, we know you're going to do well with this. So I was really excited to see this paper because I think it just backs up what you're already doing and what I'm doing in terms of doing the right thing for our patients.
And I think I've seen so many at this point through rehab where you know, there are like just little tips and tricks of like, yeah, you have to be really good about your foam rolling. You have to, like, once you get into that sort of higher intensity strengthening phases and agility phases, I feel like there's people just tend to be a little tight in their quads. So they just have to be really good about their mobility. And if they are, they're fine. You know, like they get all the strength back. And we're showing that routinely with all our isometric testing in clinic. That there's no differences side to side relative to, like, I should say there's always like a weakness, right, as they're recovering, but relative to their BTB peers, like they're accelerating their strength as far as comparing to their contralateral extremity at the same rate. So, yeah. You know, I would say just that first like 3 or 4 weeks, their straight leg raise doesn't really come around as fast, but that's it, you know?
Yeah.
So I've been really happy. You know, so Gavin, obviously, go ahead.
No, actually, I'm kind of switching topics here, but I wanted to pick your brain because today when I was talking about ACL repair, one of the PTs was demonstrating the force plates, which I know you use in your clinic, and he was talking about incorporating it into the ACL return to play test. So like, I don't know what your ACL return to play test like looks like. I do like the hop tests and, you know, limb symmetry and all that stuff. My question for you is twofold. Do you incorporate force plates into your return to play test, and have you seen a difference based on the graft?
So I haven't seen any difference based on graft. The way I use them is like, so in the beginning, I actually start testing them at 6 weeks, and all I'm doing on the force plates is making them do like mini squats. So take out that they've had like meniscus kind of stuff. If they're just straight ACLs, I'm basically just having them more like think about, it's almost like a biofeedback session where you're just like, look at the screen, try, because it's live, and they can sort of see how much, you know, they generally like, I feel like I'm 50-50, and they're totally not. They're like, so like, off to the side. And so it's more of like a get your brain to like reorient, like putting things through evenly. And then over time, we're like looking at that squat, you know, more as a test and less as a biofeedback session. But then eventually we'll do like jump squats, kind of stabilization. So when they do their single leg hop test, like when they land, like how quickly are they stabilizing on their surgical side versus their non-surgical side? So that's how we use it all for their testing. And on the jump squats, I pay a lot of attention to, you know, when they land, are they landing pretty symmetrically? Because I think that tells you a lot also about fear. Yeah. You know, if they're like, are they like, I think there's a little psychological piece there. If they're landing totally asymmetric, you're sort of like, is that, you know, a strength thing, or is that just you're scared, you know? Yeah. And I think you have to treat both differently.
Yeah, it's just very interesting. I wanted to pick your brain about that because the PT that does it a lot was saying that he had like a girl that had passed all the return to play like assessments, like 7 out of 7, which is something. Yeah. Something was off, and did like a test and just showed that she was, her deceleration on the surgical side was just like not there. It was just like completely imbalanced and all this. And I was like, wow, like, you know, I think we're in the same camp of like more data is better, like knowing someone may look great. And that's kind of why we hold people out still to 9 months, right? Even if they pass at 6 months, we still hold them out because we can't test for everything. But I think the force plate technology is a really cool thing. And I think it's awesome you're incorporating in 6 weeks so that they kind of can see that biofeedback, I think is really awesome.
Yeah. And I think it gets, and I've said this before, but they get super motivated because they're just like, most people are like, I want an A+.
You know, exactly. Yes. I've actually started telling them, I'm like, you will fail the first time you pass the test. And like, I still, like, when I show them the paper, it's like, everything says fail. They like still get very upset. I'm like, I told you we're going to fail. You're not there yet. That's why it's 9 months. But it is helpful for them to have that data and give them that extra motivation. Not that a lot of them need it.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. So ultimately, I think, you know, graft choice should be decided upon based surgeon comfort and experience. Mm-hmm. And obviously, like, we're always thinking about our individual patient characteristics. And, you know, we're always recommending that patients have an honest conversation with their surgeon, as well as like really thinking about like, what are your activities of daily living look like? What kind of sports do you like to do? Athletic endeavors? And then do you have any like pre-existing knee pain? Like, do you have like pre-existing like patella tendon or, you know, patella issues? All those things factor in, and it's just good to talk it through.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. Favorite topic.
Yes, favorite topic. Well, we should do it monthly. It's just like ACL Wednesdays. Just like
so true.
Awesome. So thank you for listening to our overtime chat. We hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as we did today. So make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on all things sports medicine. You can also watch some of our episodes on YouTube. If you like what you hear, please consider subscribing and leaving us a review. You can also reach us by email at thesportsdocspod@gmail.com or find us on Instagram at thesportsdocspod and Twitter at thesportsdocpod. We love your feedback. Have a great night.
Good night.